You've joined the BMX Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Gregory's Girl. Watching it with me is Anna Cale. Hi Anna, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm happy because you've rented a movie for us tonight that I hadn't seen in years. Now, what's so special about Gregory's Girl for you?
Oh, well, I think for me, it's the perfect comedy film. Just every scene is charming and hilarious. Nothing's wasted in it. It's just wonderful, magical and charming. And every time I watch it, and I've watched it a lot, I absolutely adore it and love every minute of it.
Coming back to it, and I know we mentioned it previously, that I hadn't seen this film in its entirety for at least 25 years. Mm. And I got it on iTunes, and it was nice that it was one of those rare films that I sat down and my wife actually wanted to watch as well. She'd never seen it, and having grown up in Finland, you know, it's not a film that gets shown there very often for probably many reasons. But coming back to it now, as you know, 25 years older, it's strange how a film seems to change so much based on perhaps where you are in life.
Mm.
I think around the time that I saw it, I was probably about the age Gregory was in this film.
Wow, okay.
And and come back to it now, sort of almost 40. It's an odd one. But I mean, I asked you if you wanted to come and do a podcast, mm-hmm. the other film that you suggested was Local Hero.
Yeah.
Which was directed by Bill Forsyth as well. Now, what do you think is so distinctive or popular about his movies that perhaps make them still quite appealing now, despite his, say, short CV?
Yeah, so he hasn't made many films, and he hasn't made a film for such a long time. But I think his films are they're simple storytelling. They're wonderful stories, wonderfully played out. He really, the scripts are fantastic. He just manages to really capture characters so well. And his first few films he wrote and directed, and you can really hear his voice in them, and it's a gently comic, wonderfully kind of magical voice. And I just think there's a magic to them, which, you know, you can revisit his films so many times and still bring something new to it, or you know, you see something you haven't seen before. And yeah, they're kind of timeless, really. A lot of his work's obviously late 70s, early 80s, and yeah, you don't notice the flares and the, you know, the kind of dodgy haircuts. You just see those characters come alive, and I think he's such a talented director, and I'd love to see him make something again. You know, hopefully he will, who knows. There's always rumours that he might work again and direct again. But yeah, there's something really magical, particularly about Gregory's Girl and Local Hero. And yeah, his other two that I really love are That Sinking Feeling and Comfort and Joy, which is actually one of my favourites as well, which is a mid-80s Christmas film. Well, it's set at Christmas. And that's just brilliant too. So yeah, I just absolutely love his films and his way of making those films.
You look at this film and how it opens. There's essentially a group of young guys. I mean, these guys, and the year that it's set at school, I mean, they say they're fourth year, so I mean, I assume they're 15, 16.
Yeah.
And we open with four or five guys lurking in the bushes outside hospital lodgings, looking through the window to see a nurse undress. It's sort of strange that when you look at a lot of films where that would be a plot line, and I suppose you could be thinking maybe Porky's or even American Pie or something,
yeah,
and the film can go in a very different direction altogether. And yet this one somehow manages to keep it almost, oh, those scamps, aren't they adorable?
Yeah, it's true to its kind of its teenage roots. You know, it is very much about teenagers and the way that they behave, but it's not crude in the way that a lot of the American maybe teen films are, and kind of going for the crude, you know, kind of one liner or the kind of the payoff in the scene. It's just you accept that initial scene for what it is, and it kind of you know that that's how teenage boys kind of you know that's what they do. I first saw this film when I was 11 at school. I'll tell you the story because it's quite amusing. My drama teacher when I was at secondary school, so I went to quite a rubbish, you know, local secondary school, kind of a working class town. And our drama teacher happened to be the son of a famous Scottish footballer who was from Liverpool himself. And he was, for whatever reason, in Leeds teaching at some dodgy comprehensive school and teaching drama. And he was fantastic. He was a fantastic teacher. One of the first things he did, and I bet he did this every year for every new intake of students, was sit them down and make them watch Gregory's Girl and Kes. So that's what we did. So we watched Gregory's Girl. And bear in mind, you know, he wheeled the big telly in. You got a group of lads, you know, 11, 12-year-olds watching that initial scene. You can imagine their reaction to that. But all of those kids just sat and watched that film and loved every minute of it. And I think that's, you know, it's one of those films that just gets you and captures, you know, your imagination straight away. And one of the brilliant things about it is it's only 90 minutes long as well, which is the perfect length for a film, by the way.
No, I wouldn't argue with that. I think now, partly through obligations, you know, we sit there and look at what film are we going to watch tonight, and maybe it's because we've got two young kids and it's kind of, right, which one isn't going to take too long? And yeah. when you record one off the telly and it's 2.5-3 hours, you think, I'm never going to get around to that. But it was also nice to hear that, and I guess it's probably a thing of most schools around that time, having the TVs on the wheels,
yes,
like everyone had. I remember, I think that was the first time I'd watched, weirdly, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. They wheeled in the telly and that, and it was, I remember bits of the film, but then the bit at the end where he said shit and you had countless dozen kids giggling and the school teachers running around going, ah.
Yeah, it was just, you know, obviously quite a few years after it was released, but yeah, it was still, yeah, everyone just kind of loved it, and having the telly wheeled in is always a moment, isn't it, when you're at school.
Yeah, and I guess this, the Boys in the Bush, that was very much a pre-internet thing, you know, things.
Yeah.
Kids today have it so easy, don't they?
Oh, they do, don't they? Yeah, oh, yeah.
The young fellas turning up afterwards as well.
Yeah.
All that fuss over a bit of tit.
A lot of fuss over a bit of tit, eh? Yeah. Hey, look, the knickers. Oh, yeah.
I know, the worldly wiseness of those younger kids is just hilarious all the way through the film, actually. That kind of motif keeps coming back up, you know, the kind of the younger kids and the wiseness, you know, compared to their slightly older counterparts is quite funny.
But I guess this film being set in a school of kids of mostly around 15 to 16, you know, there's very little screen time or script for any adult in the film,
yeah,
other than the odd teacher. It's sort of almost reminiscent of a John Hughes film in that way. But he seems to write, I mean, particularly Gregory, you know, that sort of marriage of the right script and the right actor just seems to work absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, John Gold Sinclair is such a great actor, and he inhabits that character so well. Obviously, the way he looks and acts physically kind of just is perfect for the role. You know, his kind of gangliness and his kind of awkwardness is just wonderful, and it's kind of, yeah, that perfect combination of two things coming together. And I'm going to sound like a real Bill Forsyth train spotter here, some of the cast also appeared in That Sinking Feeling, which came out a couple of years before Gregory's Girl. Mm. So there's a little bit of familiarity there as well, you know, with the kind of the actors that he obviously used for that film appearing in this one. Young actors, you know, kind of the right age group for the film, you know, kind of just about. And it's kind of, yeah, the casting is always perfect in his films. In every film, it gets it just bang on.
Well, one thing I always remember about the film, and I know it's kind of anchored around football, it was always kind of associated with football, you know, when I was growing up and that. But, you know, other than, you know, it's the main plot device is that Gregory is the centre forward for this awful school football team and replaced eventually by a girl who takes his place, and he then sort of becomes besotted with her. Weirdly, the football, albeit at the beginning, is quite prominent, but throughout the film it becomes very much the secondary to his, I'd say, pursuit of her sounds a bit predatory. Bear in mind, you know, you can look at him and think this man is not a predator.
Yeah, well, the thing for me is actually I don't think it's him doing the chasing. Actually, it's the girls that are running rings around him, and it's their plotting that gets that, you know, date between them, or, you know, the fake date, to ultimately kind of result in, you know, what is the inevitable kind of outcome of the film. I don't think he's got a plotting bone in his body, and he's really played, but in a really lovely, gentle way by all those people around him.
The part of the beginning where he turns up late for school and he's walking across the football pitch being watched by the teachers just shows this sort of complete lack of his own awareness.
Oh, completely. And even before that, when his dad almost runs him over when he's giving a driving lesson, and the conversation between them is hilarious, you know, about the fact, oh, you know, how's mum? Oh, yeah, no, she's fine. She sends her love. It's kind of just that kind of dry sense of humour It's just lovely.
Yeah, because well, the way they portray him is that he almost lives alone, or yeah. It appears that he lives alone, or you know, or yeah. To go a different way, you know, he lives with his 10-year-old sister who almost looks after him.
Oh, definitely. And one thing I noticed rewatching it, you know, for the podcast, obviously I watched it again, any excuse. I noticed when he was making his breakfast before he went to school late, just some of the little touches in that scene are just wonderful, with all the electrical items in the kitchen. He turns everything on and everything is electrical and it's all going off at the same time. It's the most ridiculous scene. And then he appears to eat a dog biscuit with cheese spread on it for breakfast. And you don't know for certain if that is the case, but that's inferred. And then he just goes to school really late, just wanders in. And it's just such a lovely little start to the film.
Looking at it from, again, from modern eyes, I mean, bear in mind, the film's almost 40 years old. You know, it's set in one of these new towns that were built. Yes. And I mean, doing some reading around it, it was Cumbernauld, where they were trying to sort of relieve the pressures on housing around Glasgow in particular. And I guess this must be a strange little world to live in, where, you know, people are kind of, whether they're thrown together or anything, but there's a community that's trying to find its identity. And this young man who's, again, in that boat, you know, living his, again, from modernised, perhaps slightly eccentric ways with his toothbrush and so on. You know, there's not a huge social commentary in there, but there are definitely things to see watching it now that you kind of find, you know, again, it's very much dependent on where you live, but you know, he just lives in his own little, I would say, world, but he just seems so innocent. Yeah. And that's portrayed, and it's not just the haircut, you know, which I know you said you didn't notice the flares and the haircut, but it was one of the first things I saw. And
yeah, they're pretty obvious, really, aren't they?
But again, funny that my wife watched it the other day, and she kind of commented even that, you know, she didn't understand a huge amount of what was said. Whereas, I mean, for me, I mean, my dad's part of the family grew up in Stranraer, so that part of Scotland. But I read that they had to dub a lot of the Scottish for the American release. I'd love to see that version.
Well, yeah, sorry, again, I'm putting my Trainspotter hat on again here, but yeah, that was part of the problem with this, and particularly the film before, That Sinking Feeling, which was released with a dubbed version in America, and then that became the only version that was available over here for many, many years. So I've seen both versions of that film. I only saw the proper original version really recently, because the BFI re-released it. And the original release of That Sinking Feeling was the dubbed version, and it was just so disappointing. It takes a lot of the charm and, you know, kind of hilarity out of it by trying to kind of water down these really authentic voices. And it just seems, you know, such a waste, really, you know, that had to happen, or it was perceived that had to happen for it to find a market. You know, these stories are, you know, they span the generations, they span, you know, kind of, you know, across the world. Everybody can relate to the awkwardness of your teenage years. You know, why try and water that down? You know, it speaks for itself, whether you can, as you say, understand every line or not.
I mean, one of the parts I found interesting, again, I try not to go, oh, well, modernise and all that, but watching the football trial, where you have, to be honest, it looks like a police lineup of misfits. And then Dorothy turns up all kitted up, and again, you know, this is a different part of my nerdiness, is that they're all wearing football kit now that you kind of look at it and think, oh, wow, this proper vintage, you know, peak Umbro this, and the Adidas kit bags and stuff. But she runs rings around them. But she is kind of saying to the teacher, well, you didn't say, you know, all boys only, and you're not allowed to do that anyway. So again, with the whole sort of, you know, equal opportunities or the diversity angle there, it's already starting to show that, you know, why shouldn't a girl play in a team?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it's accepted pretty soon in as well. He is accepting of that situation. He finds it perplexing, but, you know, pretty much once he sees her playing, he knows that, you know, there's absolutely no reason why she shouldn't play. You know, it doesn't become a thing, it doesn't become a barrier, and the plot doesn't concentrate on that either, which, you know, it could have done in a different film. It's just accepted, she's the best player. And you know, she's picked for the team, and it's kind of that inevitable thing, you know, once you see her skills. And Dee Hepburn, who kind of played the role of Dorothy, the football playing girl, she actually trained with a team up in Scotland, I think, as part of her preparation for the film, to kind of hone her football skills. You know, so what you see there, you know, that is her kind of, you know, she'd gone through the motions of training and kind of you know, learning those basic football skills for the role.
Yeah, I understand it was the mighty Partick Thistle.
Oh, was it?
But then Gregory actually had a Partick Thistle scarf in his bedroom, which I noticed. So
okay.
I wonder if that was an early effort at product placement or something like that.
Possibly, possibly.
Yeah, and I think some of the kids had kits in their colours as well. So.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I just wouldn't spot.
Yeah, they're the ones that look like Tannock's or the caramel wafers. Yes, but again, like you say, that other than that scene of the trial where she's kind of trying to justify why she's there, once she gets in the team, it's not mentioned at all. I mean, other than the fact that there is an attractive girl playing for the boys' football team.
Yeah, and of course, when she scores a goal, every boy on the pitch, including the opposition, are there to hug her and kiss her and congratulate her on such a fantastic goal, which is just really funny.
But they also brought around one of the better lines, or well, say the better of many, when the coach is called into the head's office to explain why is there a girl in the football team, and said, what about the showers? The shower situation. Oh, she brings her own soap.
Yeah.
As though that makes everything all right. Just, I mean, that teacher is just, he's so portrayed so brilliantly as all sort of part inept, but mostly just pure innocence.
I was just going to say, yeah, he's such an innocent. You know, when he teased the teachers for growing a dash as well in the staff room, and you just, oh, yeah, he kind of, there's an innocence to him, a character, which is, you know, it's really sweet.
That scene with the teasing, I mean, that could very much be misconstrued because they're talking about receiving sort of love poems from the students. And
yeah, I didn't know that watching, actually.
You kind of think that, you know, there's nothing to say that anything bad happened or anything dodgy, but you know, in the current climate, you know, I mean, that they'd never be able to get away with that now.
No, absolutely not. It's inferred, isn't it? Subtly inferred, but I think we kind of know that that's what they're hinting at. But you wouldn't have batted an eyelid when that first came out, or even, you know, kind of, you know, until recent years, it would go unnoticed. But I think now, as you say, seeing it with new eyes, there's a little bit of a wouldn't get away with that now.
But I think that's part of the fun. I think is that, you know, that there was no malice intended and no weirdness. You know, it was just a part of. It's probably just a part of life, you know. Teachers would boast around being probably the most fancied or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. And I won't go into details about what happened at my school in terms of, you know, some of those kind of flirtation, particularly with student teachers and the sixth formers. It was different times.
Yeah, of course, it's the other way around. That was always the dream, wasn't it, if you were a teenage boy? But,
yeah, well, exactly. And that actually, I probably shouldn't say this, but at my school, I'm the youngest of three, so I had two older brothers who'd both attended that school before me. My oldest brother, who I might mention again, actually, when we're talking about maybe the relationship with Gregory's little sister, but my middle brother was, when I started school, so he just left the fifth year when I started in the first year. And when a teacher saw my surname and said, oh, you're not related to I won't say his name, so and so, you know, the female teachers, it was always, oh, are you related, oh, you know, and they're all, this look came across their faces in terms of, you know, oh, I really miss him, wasn't he lovely? But the male teachers was always a look of fear in their eyes when they mentioned my difficult middle brother and his time through that school. But yeah, the female teacher in particular, he obviously held quite a charm over them, and you can see that as well in Gregory's girl with the returning pupil, the washing the windows, and the reaction of that female teacher when he appears at the window, and the conversation she has. It's kind of that I'm really glad you've come back to see me kind of thing. It was quite familiar to me with, you know, the reaction my brother used to get.
Well, this guy, I mean, jumping ahead slightly, it was Billy, wasn't it, the window cleaner?
Right,
he's portrayed as this. And again, you know, bear in mind what era it was, it, you know, not far off the sort of Confessions of a Window Cleaner sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, and I guess he must have been, what, 17?
Oh, if that, really, yeah. He's probably just finished school, you know, got his first job, yeah.
talking about, you know, is this Lothario who's saying, was it, well, foreplay is important, you know, was giving this sage advice.
Yeah, and they're all hanging on his every word because he, you know, is the only one. And he's got his white jacket as well, so he must know what he's talking about.
Oh, he's dead smooth.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, one thing I found odd was the bit where Gregory's sister Madeline is waiting for him outside the school, and then he turns up as well, and they're just kind of sort of standing there thinking, are you going to hit on her?
Well, that's it. Oh, yeah, it was, yeah. She's still at primary school, isn't she?
Yeah. I think she's, well, I said one of the boys later on said, was it,
They grow up fast, don't they? 10 years old with a body of a woman of 13.
Yeah. Again, a little bit, yeah. But then there's the boy that calls for her, who's obviously her boyfriend or whatever, or her admirer, and it's that kind of sweetness again of, you know, 2 10-year-olds who, friends or whatever, was really sweet as well. But I love Madeline. She's a wonderful little character. And as I say, it reminded me, that relationship reminded me of my older brother, who's 7 years older than me. And when he was in his teens, I would give him advice on his love life.
Okay.
As a kind of 10, 11-year-old, at night he'd come home and he'd be worried because he fancied a girl and she didn't fancy him and what should he do and all this kind of thing. So I would be giving him advice about that, and when he finally got a girlfriend, he obviously immediately was just completely besotted and spent every waking moment with her, and we didn't see each other as much, and we used to write each other little notes, and I made little post boxes to put on our bedroom door so that when we didn't see each other, we could kind of catch up on, you know, what was happening. But yeah, I remember conversations with my brother that were really similar to Madeline and Gregory, and it's just lovely to kind of see it now, you know, that innocence and that kind of closeness between them is really, really sweet. And it's actually now, looking back now, you know, my mum, myself, now I've got a 9-year-old girl, and seeing that sweetness is in that, I see it with new eyes, as you know, as a mum. That relationship between those siblings is just perfectly done in the film, I think.
I like the fact that the way she's sort of written, particularly the scene in the Wimpy where she's giving him advice about sort of what to wear and how to act, and yet there are still parts of her that are a 10-year-old girl.
Yes.
Where she's talking about what she wants, you know, it's the drink with the green thing, monstrosity. Yes. That, you know, again, just as an item of drink would probably never be allowed now, but you know, the fact that she could be written as this wise being, and yet we're still reminded very much so that yes, she is a child. Mm. She just happens to be so much wiser beyond her years. Yes. About, well, about certain things anyway.
Yeah, well, girls are at that age. Anyway.
It's scary. Mine have still got a way to go before they hit 10, but yeah, I'm fully expecting them to turn into little Yoda type things.
yeah, they probably will.
Throughout the film, she's giving Gregory advice. I mean, it's obviously mostly about Dorothy to start with, but when he goes on, I suppose, the ultimate date in the end, which for someone, you know, I hadn't seen it in so long, I'd kind of almost forgotten about that part. The way it's done, the fact that he ends up kind of going on, I suppose, 3 dates at once, and not one of them with the person he thought he'd be going out with.
Yes.
I mean, it sounds almost farcical, but, you know, there's enough there to remind people that, you know, the women or the girls, they know what they're doing. There's clearly an ultimate goal here that he just goes along completely oblivious to everything.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that I really love about the film, is the way that the female characters are treated. You know, there's no difference between the male and female characters. You don't feel a difference there. They are equally as, you know, the screen time, the way that they're treated by the script, and, you know, that kind of thing. There's a real kind of equality there. I particularly love Susan as a character. I think she's wonderful, and I wanted to be her as a teenager. I think, in fact, at one stage I had a beret and kind of was trying to kind of recreate her look and kind of be just like her. And I think she's so perfectly kind of presented as this kind of level-headed but interesting girl. I wanted to be like her, and I think that's quite rare in a teen film. You know, they are attainable characters. You don't feel there's this kind of glamour or whatever to them. They are interesting and funny and lovely, but you feel you could be them, or you could, you know, you could date them or you could be friends with them. And I think that's really key success to the film, is that kind of attainability of those characters, and particularly the girls. They're just, it's so nicely done, the way that they kind of lead Gregory around town that on that evening on that date. It's just wonderfully, wonderfully done.
I mean, it sounds like I'm big-headed. I mean, something like that's not happened to me before, but I'd find it, it must be really strange, you know, putting myself in his position, to be semi-obsessed with someone, think you're going out on a date with this sort of stunning person, and then to literally go around the houses and the chip shop, and then end up with someone who is almost certainly in every other way completely more suitable for you.
Yeah.
I mean, what a mindfuck it was.
Yeah. But to be honest, it's not that different from my internet dating days in the mid-2000s, to be honest, where you thought you were going to be seeing someone and someone else seemed to turn up on the date. You know, it's kind of, yeah.
What's that called? Is that catfishing?
Catfishing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's kind of, yeah, the manoeuvring, yeah, you could see is slightly suspicious, but actually, again, it's treated so nice, you know, it's so sweet in the way it's kind of done. And I quite like the I can't remember which, I think the first girl, maybe, I can't remember which order it's in, where she gets changed in the phone box and it's not explained, you know, where she's going on to or what she's doing. And that's one of the things that I love about the film, is the unexplained elements of it. So things will happen and you're not given any explanation about them, you know, just these lovely little things that just keep coming up. The fact she got changed into this really kind of quite, you know, more raunchy outfit, and it's like, where's she going? What's she doing?
And then the fact that he wouldn't walk next to her or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I love the fact that, you know, the ultimate thing was to go to a chip shop.
Yes.
You know, I grew up on an estate, albeit in North London, and the chip shop there was always kind of the focal point.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. My first day, I sat on the wall of a petrol station. That's essentially all we did. You know, it's kind of, that's what happens in these towns. It's like, there's nothing else to do. You know, there's no glamour to it, in the sense that that's your estate, that's where you are. And Cumbernauld, I guess, in that way, is no different to, you know, the estates, you know, you and I grew up on.
So I guess if you got flowers from that petrol station at that age, it was probably a delight. But if you got them now, you'd know that something was wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
But I noticed that, again, this is me doing my thing. Apparently the chip shop Capaldi's was actually owned by the family of Peter Capaldi, the Doctor Who fella.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, that is about the extent of my knowledge of Doctor Who, which is probably quite insulting and not surprising to most of the people I know through doing this podcast, who don't believe that I've never seen Doctor Who. But
Peter Capaldi is a great actor himself. So, you know, it's kind of, yeah, that's a nice little link, actually, isn't it?
Yeah. Go back to the point you're making about how the female characters are written in a way that, you know, they're not made out to be just sort of totty. In the way that a lot of them are. And again, whether it's deliberate or as a contrast, in the boys are very much teenage boys.
Yes.
And having been a teenage boy, it's very accurate.
I mean, absolutely.
I mean, we weren't selling photos of the attractive girls in toilet cubicles, but, but, you know, when they're talking about, was it tits, bum, fanny, the lot?
Yeah.
Tits, bum, fanny, the lot!
About the window cleaning and things like that. It's, you know, that there is that whole, it's probably not a myth at all that girls mature faster than boys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, most of the girls at my school went out with slightly older boys. You know, you didn't go out with a boy your own age.
Oh, God.
My goodness, you know, they were boys. it was kind of, yeah, that difference is really obvious, I think, in that particular age group between boys and girls. And that's a familiar thing from my own teenage years, I think.
And in Gregory's attempts to be more sophisticated, you know, when Dorothy talks to him about the Italian boy, Ronaldo.
Yes.
and again, this is something that I am obliged, I think, by law to mention, that every time I mention Gregory's girl on social media, someone will reply saying, Bella, Bella.
Yes, definitely. And it is the law. You have to do that. Absolutely. In fact, when I mentioned I was watching the film, I got that same response from people as well who've seen the film. It's just the law. You have to do that. You absolutely have to.
Bella, Bella.
It's nice to see that, you know, he still wants to make the effort. I mean, he doesn't make much progress other than the Italian for, was it? Let's wait and see.
Yeah.
I did also find funny the part where Dorothy was interviewed for the paper. Yeah. And obviously that was the mechanism for the photographs getting into circulation. But the fact that the guy doing the interview was strange. I mean, as a sort of 15 or 16-year-old Scottish boy with this, I don't know whether it was fake or real, this almost Roger Moore-esque suave. So I was like, oh, I'd love to get to know the real you.
Yeah, well, that's journalist so boy, smooth. Isn't it? You know.
Yes. Yes. Sleazy types. But, I mean, that the whole way it's portrayed, these, I would say, it's almost like, what's that, Bugsy Malone, where the children are almost playing adults.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I think, yeah, there's an element of that in this, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think that journalist guy almost is the sort of epitome of that. He's a guy who normally would probably be on the end of a few beatings or something, but but he just comes across this way, and then there's Steve, the baker, who...
Yes.
He's so worldly wise, and you know, the way that role is reversed. I mean, you wouldn't have seen many teen movies where, you know, one of the main supporting characters is sort of an expert in pastry.
Yeah, and the way he sits with the headmaster, like surreptitiously, you know, they have to pretend it's not really happening, where he's sampling the pastries and out ordering extra food and things, and then, you know, they come out of the room and pretend it's about something else. It's just, yeah, it's lovely. But yeah, the Steve character's great, and it's there again, it's not he's a nicely rounded character, but, you know, those elements of his personality that they don't dwelt on or he's not been teased for it in any way, and that's just, he is who he is, you know, he likes bacon, and that's, you know, that's just him. Each character seems to have their own little quirk or own little thing, and that's what it's like, isn't it, at school, you know, everyone has their own little kind of quirky thing.
It would be easy, I suppose, in a film that was a bit more paint by numbers, to kind of punch down or to just paint him as a very, you know, whether it be camp or gay or anything like that. But there's none of that at all. No. I mean, obviously he's, you know, slightly more, I mean, he's got earrings, and the way he carries himself is a bit more, well, I wouldn't even say flamboyant, it's just slightly different.
More grown up in a way. When Gregory comes into the cooking class, you know, late, and says he's in love with someone on the football team, and Steve says, oh, right, okay, have you told anyone else about this? And then he obviously reveals it's a girl. You know, it's that kind of, that lovely acceptance in that moment, you know, that, right, okay, yeah, cool, you know, I'm your friend and we'll talk about it kind of thing. It's actually really sweet.
I mean, I just, you know, looking at it now, it's just, again, with the benefit of hindsight and comparing it to films that, yeah, I mean, it would be churlish to compare this to American Pie, I suppose, would be the obvious thing. But to see how it's written, and that's all in that, and the direction as well, to show that, you know, boys, teenage boys, are mostly just trying to be, yeah, there might be an ambition to appeal to women, but ultimately it's, you know, so it sounds twee to say, but it's a very sweet film.
It is, yeah. They kind of do that thing of teenage boys talking about, you know, the kind of the, you know, seeing, you know, women's whatever's, and kind of they had, there's all that talk, but ultimately they're looking for romance, you know, the two other boys as well, who are always looking for romance and trying to chat the girls up. And I was going to mention Charlie, who is one of my favourite characters, who does not speak all through the film until right at the very last scene, where you hear Charlie speak, and he comes up with this most wonderful, you know, little kind of monologue about it'll be all right and we'll be fine, and, you know, da da da, and it's just wonderfully played by those two boys. They just want to find nice girls and have, you know, get girlfriends. And the way that Gregory assumes nothing on that date with Susan, ultimately, you know, it's very sweetly done, and it's a kiss, you know, at the end of the night when she's walked him home. You know, it's very innocent and very sweet, and you know, you wouldn't get that in, you know, more modern films, and particularly not your American Pie type films, where that is, you know, they would go for the other kind of type of storyline and not actually consider that, you know, boys are just the same as girls. What they want is to meet someone nice and, you know, have a nice date and, you know, meet a nice girl. Yeah, it's just so nicely done.
You know, there's no sort of ultimate ambition for a nasty fumble behind the bike sheds or anything like that.
Because to be honest, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just innocent and wide-eyed, but I don't remember anyone at my school that was their expectation from a first date, to be honest, you know, at that age. You know, you were just lucky if you got a date and didn't sit on a petrol station wall for it, you know.
Ooh, she held my hand.
Yeah, exactly.
The boys who... they sit down next to the two girls at the school lunch, and immediately their sort of method of chatting up is how they slaughter calves to make veal. I mean, in the grand scheme of chat-up lines, that's bold.
Do you know how they make veal? They get the little baby calves, and they hang them upside down, and they slap their throats and let the blood drip out. It's very interesting, isn't it?
I mean, it's up there. It I mean, is. I can't see being on, you know, websites as the number one way to woo a lady, but, you know, I mean, there might be a certain type of lady who's into that sort of thing. There was also the sort of side plot at the end where they were going to move to Caracas because of the, I guess it's a myth, that there are 8 women to every man.
Yeah, that's so funny. On the way they're pitching at the end of the film.
But it's so silly, but it's such a small joke that they milk just enough in the way that they focus on the fact that they're not getting picked up for a lift to Caracas because he spelt Caracas wrong.
Yeah, that's the reason. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's not the fact it's as they say, a 9,000-mile drive. I wonder if that's true, though, because, I mean, there was always a thing when I was at school when people were applying for universities, and I think Nottingham, there was a rumour going around, and again, this was sort of mostly pre-internet in mid-90s, where people say, oh, you've got to go to Nottingham because the university there's 6 girls to every bloke, and it's a target-rich environment.
Yeah, that was a rumour, yeah. Okay. I remember that when I was applying for university as well.
Is that what... did you put down Nottingham?
No, I didn't. No.
Okay, well, it's tough competition.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess it was implied that Dorothy was involved in the engineering of this, but it's just such a strange, you know, to me being formerly a teenage boy, and again, not having really done internet dating, I wouldn't know about the catfishing element to it either, but it's, you know, a plan. It's sort of Fort Knox style in its execution. Mm. Everything had to go completely to plan. I suppose it would say like clockwork, but then that was the giant clock they met on, or were supposed to meet on.
That's right, yeah. It's amazing, you know, the assumption that it would go right. I don't quite know what they'd have done if Gregory turned away and walked away, but I think they would have known that the likelihood that would be very, very low.
He's a nice boy. He's not going to run off.
Exactly. Yeah, when a girl says, can you buy me some chips? He's not going to say no, is he?
No. I mean, again, just the fact that he's portrayed as this guy who's, you know, he's happy to go along and see where it leads. This isn't a kind of... Mm-hmm. You know, where everything's black and white, and even when he gets to Susan at the end and she's there waiting, looking very sort of, I suppose, sophisticated in the beret, he goes along with it and has this sort of deep and meaningful, but, you know, and their whole conversation ends up revolving around numbers.
Oh, I love that scene so much. It's such a wonderful date, and I think one of the things I love about the film is that Cumbernauld looks so beautiful in that film, and it's a modern, you know, it's a new town, it's got this kind of aesthetic of it, very unique kind of look to it. And that's one of the things in Bill Forsyth's film, is that sense of place is really kind of common across all of his films, where Cumbernauld looks beautiful in the kind of the summer sunlight, you know, as the sun is setting across the country park. It's just beautiful and glorious, and it evokes such a wonderful feeling of those long summer evenings, you know, when you're that age, where it's just like, you know, it's a magical kind of feeling to it. And that conversation they have is just wonderful about the number, why do boys like numbers so much, and then their favourite numbers. And I have to admit, you know, I've recreated that scene where we were born in the past, you know, that thing about what's your favourite number. It's it evokes such kind of a sweetness to that relationship, but also a kind of cleverness and a kind of the wittiness of both of them. So they're both really funny and witty in that that scene, and that's what I always wanted, you know, from me and a boy, is to just find someone who could match me, you know, for witty one-liners and kind of just have an entertaining conversation with, you know, and that's what you get from them too. They're obviously so well matched. You know, Susan obviously knows that beforehand, that they would make a good pair, and it's just perfect. You know, they are meant to be together.
It's funny that I read something about one of the articles, and it was kind of suggesting that, oh, well, they probably didn't stay together, they probably didn't end up together, and all this. And it's kind of like, well, okay, well, we don't know, and that's the point.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's, you know, I mean, how many of these teenage romances ever do go anywhere? Probably not very many.
But yeah, and this is the thing. So that I've seen most of Bill Forsyth's films, but one film I purposely haven't seen is Gregory's Two Girls, which is a follow-up. I have not seen it. I don't know what happens in it, and I don't want to know, because I don't want to pursue that character any further. It ends on that date, that, you know, the end of the night. It's the perfect end to that film. And I kind of, you know, I've ummed and ahed in the past about watching it, but decided I don't want to see it, because I want to think that it's the perfect end to a perfect film.
Now, I did. I haven't seen this either, and to be honest, there's nothing about it that really appeals. But
no.
I did have a look at the synopsis for it.
Yes.
It says, 20 years after his teenage crush on a football-mad schoolgirl, Gregory is back at his old school teaching English. Now, there's no mention of Susan there whatsoever.
No.
When two of his pupils uncover evil practices at a local factory, they want their teacher to help them expose the wrongdoer, who happens to be Greg's old school friend.
Yeah.
Now, I could see why the whole plot line of uncovering, you know, wrongdoing at a factory would be, you know, you could probably make a film about it. Quite what the tie-in to Gregory's Girl is, I mean, that is tenuous at best.
Yeah, there's no tie-in other than the school and the fact it's called Gregory.
I don't know, was John Gordon Sinclair in need of some work at the time or something like that? But
possibly. Although, I mean, obviously I'm a big fan of John Gordon Sinclair, and he's a great comic actor, and he his career has been an interesting one, and he did a couple of kind of TV shows, including probably one series of a sitcom where he was a journalist on a local paper called Nelson's Column, which nobody else remembers, as far as I know, apart from me. And it's kind of, he's always kind of played these kind of bumbling kind of slightly innocent characters, you know, but he's I don't know, I kind of, you know, I hate to kind of talk about someone's career as if there's, you know, I don't know about it, but yeah, it's just for me he'll always be Gregory. But I believe he's a writer now, quite a successful novelist.
And one thing I noticed quite recently was he is the narrator for Biggleton, which is a CBeeb show that my daughter quite enjoys.
Well, you see, I haven't seen that because obviously my daughter is too old for CBeebies now. She just watches constant Formula One and Challenge TV. Okay. So that's something for you to look forward to. I don't know whether every child is the same. But so I don't get to see these wonderful shows. Oh, I didn't know he's narrating that. That's lovely, actually. He's got such a wonderful voice.
It is, yeah, because it works really well. I mean, going in, I could do a whole podcast about the crap they watch. but it's set in like a cardboard village where boys and girls are the policeman and the doctor and do all these jobs. And, you know, they introduce themselves at the start of each show and they wave, and then my daughter waves back to them. And then John Gordon Sinclair is narrating, and he's just got this, you know, again, of course it's the same person, but it sounds like Gregory, albeit a lot more sort of, a little bit more velvety. But it just sounds very, it sounds comfortable and it's nice.
What makes the perfect town? Is it the hard-working town folk?
Hello!
The bustling, independent high street? Or the ever-present sense of community? Welcome to Biggleton, where you can find all of these things in abundance. A town with a growing population, Biggleton is well maintained.
And there's a familiarity there, isn't there? And I think he's one of those characters, and it's one of those films where he will always be, always have that special place, you know, for people who've seen the film and enjoyed it, that he is that character, which is wonderful. But it's also, obviously, I guess as an actor, that must be quite annoying. And obviously, you know, Susan went on, obviously, the Claire Grogan was quite a favourite. Whenever I mention Claire Grogan, my husband's eyes kind of light up. You know, she was a favourite for many a young man, an older man now. And obviously, she had a pop career, and, you know, with her band, and kind of they sang Happy Birthday. And kind of had a few other hits and stuff, and Altered Images, that was it, wasn't it?
That's the one.
So she had that lovely little career, and she looks fantastic now. She's great, you know, whenever you see her speaking, she's really kind of still as cool as she was in that film for me. You know, she's still fantastic.
But I remember in the mid-90s, you know, whenever you switch on BBC Two, more often than not, it'd be her doing something.
Oh, excellent.
But he was always this kind of cool Scottish lady. I suppose she would have been that time, I guess, sort of mid to late 30s.
Yeah.
But again, she just seemed to be like everywhere for this period of time on BBC Two. And I'm sure someone will tell me I'm completely wrong. But you kind of associate her with that. But then you think, you know, going back at that time, you know, we didn't have Wikipedia or anything. Mm. And you can say, oh, Claire Grogan, she was on the bloody telly. But then you think, no, she was a singer, she was an actress, she was this. And yeah, and I guess I did see something recently in the Guardian about they got John Gordon Sinclair and Claire Grogan back together because apparently they're still very good friends.
Oh, lovely.
And they were talking about sort of the impact of the film and how they enjoyed making it and how they stayed sort of close together, which, and again, imagine if they did sort of end up together and get old and married, and he's still punching above his weight.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But to me, and this might sound a bit random, but in some ways, his character reminds me of Jimmy Stewart. You know, some of his films and that kind of thing. You know, the kind of slightly gangly, taller, bit awkward kind of character, kind of ending up with the more kind of streetwise, you know, kind of woman. But with that innocence that he brought to the role, I think John Gordon Sinclair had a similar kind of essence to him in the performance as well. You know, I think there's kind of some similarities there, perhaps.
I could see that. Yeah. It's just the only bad thing I think is that the when you look online and you see some of the publicity photos or the posters for the film, and it's him gawking at Dorothy.
Oh yeah,
and he's pulling this face that it kind of reminds me of when they used to do in The Simpsons what a young Mr. Burns looked like.
Yeah,
and you kind of think like, oh, what a bad time to press click on that camera.
Yeah, is it where he's looking at her knee? Then it's like, it's not like that. That scene is one. I love that scene. In fact, that might be one of my favourite scenes in the film, where they're in the changing rooms and she's talking about her scars, and he looks at the scar on her knee, and then he says the line about his arm and the fact that he hurt his arm once and he can't get it any further up than you know, and he puts his arm up to, you know, and he said, oh, I can't get it up any further than this now. I used to be able to get it up here. And then he moves his arm and says, but now I can only get it down to here. And it's just great. it's such a lovely little scene, that
scene in the shower. It's kind of one of those where if you're a bloke, you know, you are trying to impress, going, oh yeah I used to be able to do this, but you know, I've got this injury, and also she calls him out on it but doesn't hold it against him.
I think she sees his innocence and sweetness for it is, really.
Yeah. And you know, again, ultimately, you know, sort of winding down a bit, but you know, watching the film now, I wonder if it's one of those films that perhaps, you know, your viewpoint of it changes. But I mean, for me, it didn't half just remind me of what was I like when I was that age.
Oh, completely. Definitely.
For good or bad reasons. Hopefully, I'm not like the teacher now.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. It just bring back all your own memories of your own youth and kind of what you must have looked and come across like. And I think everybody, it's a universal kind of feeling, isn't it? Everybody feels like that as a teenager, surely.
Yeah, I guess me as a teenager in the mid-90s would have had my ridiculous effort at probably an Oasis haircut and stupidly oversized trainers. And I guess people in 10, 15 years will probably look back at that and think, what an idiot. So. Yeah, and I didn't get off with anyone in the football team.
There is that.
Yes, anyway. Well, Anna, thank you for bringing this copy of Gregory's Girl, and it was a joy to rewatch. So thank you again for
thank
that.
You.
Now, you seem to be popping up with your film writing anywhere reputable. I've seen you on Film Stories, Little White Lies, We Are Cult. Tell us a bit about what we can find from your writing.
Yeah, so I've written, as you say, for a few, I guess, film-related and TV-related websites and publications. You can also find me on the BFI website as well. I've got a couple of pieces on there. Just kind of writing about film from a kind of... Yeah, slightly different perspective. I like things that people might have forgotten about and kind of need a good reminder of. I think that's maybe where I like to find myself. But yeah, various places and kind of various publications and things. I've also done a few interviews with people as well, which is lovely. I love interviewing, and you can find some of my interviews on the Culture Vultures website, which is another site that I write quite regularly for. I'm also going to be starting my first book soon, which is quite exciting. And I'm nerve-wracking, frightening, all of those words, really.
How much are you able to tell us about that?
I can tell you that it's a film-related biography. So it's right up my street, really. Sadly, not a book about Bill Forsyth, which is obviously the dream.
Yes, well, as long as you're not stepping on my toes by doing one about Steve Guttenberg, then happy days.
Yeah, no, you're safe there, that's fine.
Well, that's great. And your Twitter account is real_meaning.
That's right.
And that's a, you know, again, plenty of interviews and your links on there. And it's always a good. I know you talk about your adventures with your daughter, who's the new Madeline.
Yeah, she's quite a character. Yeah, she's a filmmaker herself. So, you know, you might be talking about one of her films on your podcast one day.
Yeah, so by the time I get round to, once I get past Laserdisc Video Club and DVD, what's now? iTunes, Netflix?
YouTube Video Club.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing what she produces. Yeah. Well, as per usual, I'll play out the podcast with the song that was number one in the UK at the time of the film's release. Now, this was the 23rd of April 1981, and it was Making Your Mind Up by Bucks Fizz. Blimey. There's one to remind you of when it was 1981. And I guess being a Scottish film, I suppose you could do the thing with the skirts, but with kilts, but that probably got quite silly. But anyway, Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll speak to you
soon.
Thank
you. Bye-bye. Making your mind up. Don't let your indecision take you from behind. Trust your inner vision.
This episode is brought to you with executive producers Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Andy Elliott, and Chris Hopkins, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, and more. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on iTunes.